from stuff we've been doing yesterday, day before, last week, whatever. So I got a report from Sarah on the tutorial, but how did you guys find it? Okay. Okay. Today we're going to be talking about the problem of factoring. And specifically, we're going to start to talk about Shor's algorithm for factoring numbers on a quantum computer. So factoring, of course,
Well, I have a question.
Yeah, sure.
Those gates and things like that, is it like people have insight about what they're doing, or is it just trial and error when they want to build an algorithm?
No, I mean, certainly people have some insight. Maybe it's easier to explain in the context of today's lecture. But basically, there's certain types of gates, you kind of know what they do. And then, so you have some intuition about what these, some subroutine would do. And so you have to then figure out how to put those together to do what you want. It's definitely more than trial and error, but there is some trial and error involved. Just coming up with algorithms is kind of a black art. There's no technique to do that. I mean, there's techniques, but there's no algorithm for finding algorithms. Let's put it that way. So today we're going to be talking about factoring, and the problem of factoring. I already introduced it probably on Friday, but just to remind you, so we're given some n, some large number n. And the goal is to find some p that divides n. And in particular, usually we have kind of the hardest case where n is a product of two primes. And you want to find the factors. If you're given P and Q, then finding N, that's easy. Right, that you just use multiplication. And multiplication, well, if you just use the simplest type of log multiplication you learned in elementary school, then the time to do this is I might as well work it out because we're gonna need it soon. So it's gonna depend only on the number of bits in the descriptions of P and Q, right? Because if you multiply one bit by a number of n bits, then that takes time n, and then you have to add up n of these things. So it's gonna take a time that's O of log n squared. So where P and Q are, could be about half the length of n. O of log n squared. Half the length of n is going to be half log n, but that doesn't change the big O, right? Because that's just a constant factor. So multiplication, this is easy. This is a polynomial time in the size of the input P and Q. Okay. But factoring, as far as we can tell, is hard on a classical computer. And one reason that we're pretty confident that it really is hard is because lots of people have put lots and lots of time and effort into trying to solve this problem. And the reason they have is that factoring is a very important problem in cryptography. So in particular, there's the RSA crypto system, something called the public key encryption system. And its security depends on factoring being hard. So if you could break factoring, if you could solve factoring efficiently, then you could break RSA. So what is RSA? What is public key encryption? So public key encryption We'll talk a bit more about cryptography next week. So you have two people, Alice and Bob. Alice wants to send a message to Bob, but there's an eavesdropper, Eve, that's listening in. And Alice wants her message to be secret so that Eve doesn't learn it. But Bob should be able to read the message. Okay? And so in a public key encryption system, in order to encrypt the message, you use a public key. And the public key is known to everyone. And in particular, Eve knows what the public key is. So Eve could encrypt her own messages to Alice. But the point of the reason the public key encryption system is supposed to be secure is that in order to decrypt the messages, to take the encrypted message and figure out what it originally said, you need the private key. And the private key is only known to Bob. Okay? So this creates kind of an asymmetry between the encoder and the decoder. There's something also called private key encryption, where the same key is used to encrypt and to decrypt. And in private key encryption, well, it's important that Eve obviously doesn't know what that private key is, that shared private key. Alice and Bob have to share it, though. Public key encryption is kind of a lot easier to use because you can have a public key, which you can just, you know, publish to the world. You can put it on your web page. You can put it in a phone directory, whatever. And then anyone can use that public key to encrypt messages to send to you. But only you'll be able to read them, because only you have the private key. And you can just keep the private key in your own computer, and you don't have to give it out. So RSA encryption is very widely used. I mean, it's the kind of the first step in a secure web connection, SSL. So you probably have used it all the time, perhaps without even realizing that. And like I said, RSA depends on factoring being hard. So what is that? How does RSA work? So RSA, by the way, is named after its inventors, Rivest, Shamir, and Edelman. And the idea of RSA is that the public key is going to be this large number n plus some other number that's going to be used as an exponent. And the private key is a different exponent, d. And the point is that the relationship, in order to generate this public key-private key pair, so d and e will be derived from the prime factorization of n. Which again is going to be a product of two large primes. And in particular, we want that x to the ed is congruent to x mod n. Let's just say equals to x mod n. OK? And then it turns out with a bit of number theory, which I'll show you in a moment, that given the prime factorization of n and one of e or d, you can find the other one. Okay, so in order to generate the public key private key pair, Bob will pick p and q, multiply them together to get n, and then use that to generate a pair of e and d. And conversely, if Eve is able to factor n, then she knows e, and so she can find d. I'll maybe say that again in a minute when I show you the number theory and the protocol, actually. OK, so So the way you can do this uses a very classic bit of number theory called Euler's theorem. And Euler's theorem says that for any x, x to the phi of n is equal to 1 mod n, where phi of n is the number of natural numbers less than or equal to n. Equal doesn't really matter since n is not going to count, which are relatively prime to n. So if n is prime, well, then that means that the number of numbers that are relatively prime to a prime number is everything. So then phi of n is n minus 1. And it turns out that if n is the product of two primes, then that means that phi of n is p minus 1 times q minus 1. And there's simple formulas. Given the prime factorization of n, it's actually there's a very simple formula to find phi of n more generally. But this is the only one I need. So this is a generalization of this Fermat's little theorem that I mentioned back when talking about primality testing. Because if you plug in the case where n is prime, that's exactly what you get back. That x to the n is equal to x mod n. Okay? So are there questions on this so far? Of RSA. So that's Rivest, Shamir, and Edelman. Any other questions? Okay, so then how do we apply Euler's theorem to find E from D or D from E? What we'd like to do, so we want, remember, that x to the ED is equal to x mod n. And so what we can do is, what we want then is that E times D should be equal to some multiple of phi of n plus 1. Right? Because if this is true, then if you take x to the ED, that's like taking x to the phi of n a bunch of times, but that doesn't do anything. That gives you 1. And then taking one more time, that gives you x. So question? No, OK. So how do we arrange that? Well, if we know p and q, then we know phi of n. And so that's where the factor knowledge of our factorization comes in. So what happens is, in order to generate the pair, we should have that. So if E is not relatively prime to phi of n, this can never happen, right? Because then suppose like E and phi of n are both divisible by 2, then the left side is even, the right this is even, but then this plus 1 will mess it up. Okay, so E has to be relatively prime to phi of n. And then if E is relatively prime to phi of n, you can use Euclid's algorithm to find D. Why is that? Well, this combination, so remember what Euclid's algorithm does, you did it in the tutorial. So what Euclid's algorithm does is, given two relatively prime numbers, e and 5n, it'll find a and b such that a times e plus b times 5n is equal to 1. And you can just identify here that d is a and b is minus k. Okay? And of course, when you know a, then you know d, because they're equal. Okay? Everyone see that? And so the only thing you needed to know to do this was 5n. And if you know the factorization of n, again, you know 5n. So that's where the factorization comes in. Yeah?
Isn't it true if x is coprime to n?
Yeah, I guess that has to be the case. Thanks. Other questions? Okay, so so what is the RSA cryptosystem? How does it work? So specifically, encryption you have some message X that you'd like to send. And there's some details in how this is actually works in practice and how you have to implement it. But just to give you the basic idea, you have some message X. And to encrypt it, the encrypted is called the ciphertext. You take it to the power E mod N. Okay? So N and E are the public key, you can see up there. And so in order to do this thing, all you need to know, the encryption, all you need to know is the public key. And then the decryption, well, perhaps you can guess, but I'll write it anyway. So if you're given the cipher, if you receive the ciphertext Y, then you are supposed to decode it to the plain text, that's the unencrypted message, y to the d mod n. Okay? And so in particular, when this is the ciphertext, then you altogether will take x to the e mod n and then take it to the power d. And x to the ed is just x mod n. Okay? So you come back to where you started. Okay? So basically we're in a situation, and okay, so now in principle it's possible that there might be some way to break RSA without actually factoring n. We don't know that for sure. But it's believed that breaking RSA, finding x given y, is basically as hard as factoring. That pretty much the only way to do it, say, is by factoring. Okay? And so in that case, and again, there's a lot of details for how this is used. You have to be careful. Actually, there's some E's that it's relatively easy to break. And certainly, there's some N's that are relatively easy to factor. So there's a lot of art to how this has to actually be implemented in the real world. But I don't want to go into that. Here's the basic problem, and I want to leave it at that. Question?
Yeah, I was going to say, well, if n is bigger than some numbers, then the known primes are kind of just Mersenne numbers or things like that, which are completely.
Yeah. So okay. So in practice, you might want to use in the real world. So there's the other thing is that if n is too big, so this thing is polynomial time, doing this modular exponentiation, and actually we'll discuss how to do that either today or tomorrow efficiently. But the time is still dependent on the number of bits in n. So if n is too long, then this is like, you know, if this is, if so this is more than order log n squared. If that's too long, if n is too big, then it'll just take a long time to do the encryption and the decryption. And you don't want that anyway. So in practice, people like to, so RSA is much slower, actually, than symmetric encryption systems, like the private key systems that I mentioned before, like AES. In practice, people use n's that are, you know, maybe 1,000 bits long or 2,000 bits long. So that's small enough that finding primes is not that big a deal. And so actually the problem of testing primality is important in this context too, because you come up with some number and you want to make sure it's prime to use as a factor here. If it's not prime, then n might be easier to factor than you think, right? Because if n has a lot of factors rather than just two factors, then it's easier to find one. Okay, other questions? So anyway, since RSA is such a big deal, people have worked really hard on factoring numbers. Certain government agencies have put a lot of money into this. I guess it's possible that they actually found a way to do that, but if so, it's not public. And I think the dominant belief is that there is no efficient classical algorithm to factor large numbers. But it turns out there is a quantum algorithm. And that's called Shor's algorithm, and that's what I'm going to be talking about today and probably tomorrow. So Shor's algorithm, to get to the quantum part of Shor's algorithm, well, you have to apply a bit more number theory, which is kind of derived from all the work that people went into factoring. They've found equivalent versions, equivalent problems that you might try to solve instead of factoring. And so one of those problems is period finding. And in particular, we want to find the period of this function, f of a, which is x to the a mod n. So we're given x and n. We want to find the period here. And so what that means precisely is that we want to find the smallest r greater than 0 such that x to the r is equal to 1 mod n. And so r is known as the order of x. Okay? So why does this help? Why does this let us factor? Well, so there's going to be a couple of things that I'll kind of go over quickly. But the basic idea is we want to find some x with even order. So one of the things I'll go over quickly is, well, it turns out that if we pick if we pick x randomly, then it turns out that with some constant probability independent of n, then we do get an x with even order. So that's what we're going to do. We're just going to pick a bunch of random x's. And then for each one, we'll find the order of x. And if it happens to be even, then we can go on to the next step. So what is the next step? So so x has even order. So what we can do is we can define y to the order of x to the order over 2, to r over 2. And that implies that y squared is equal to 1 mod n. OK? And so in particular, y squared minus 1, which is equal to y plus 1 times y minus 1, is equal to 0 mod n. So this is a multiple of n. So I should say that this modular arithmetic, if you don't have much experience with it, you can most of the time you can treat it just like regular arithmetic. You can add, you can multiply, all that stuff. The only thing you have to be careful of is when you're multiplying or dividing by something that has a is not relatively prime to n, because then you know that's like kind of like dividing by zero with regular integers. Okay, so we have y plus 1 times y minus 1 is a multiple of n. And so in particular, what that means is n has two prime factors, p and q. And those p and q have to be present somewhere on this side. And so either they both divide the same thing. So that's one possibility. So there's three possibilities. So first of all, n could divide, why don't I write them all? So we have three choices. So possibility one is that n divides y plus 1. Possibility two is that n divides y minus 1. And possibility three is that p divides y plus 1 and q divides y minus 1. So possibility two is not really possible, because that would imply that y is equal to 1 mod n, which would say that the order of x was actually r over 2, not r. But the order is defined as the smallest thing. So this is not possible. This one is possible. But again, it turns out that if you pick x randomly, then with some constant probability, this doesn't happen. So we want to avoid this case too. So again, we pick x randomly. If it's even, we're OK. We go on to the next step, which is to calculate y. But then if y is equal to minus 1 mod n, then we reject it and choose another random x, keep on going for random x. So then we're left with the third case. And the third case lets us find the factors. Because remember, p and q are prime. So in particular, p So p and q are prime. And so in this case, we're assuming that q does not divide y plus 1. And p does not divide y minus 1. OK, so it's just one factor in each. And in that case, the GCD of y plus 1 and n will be equal to p. Because n has only the factors p and q. Q doesn't divide y plus 1. P does. So it's the GCD. And so therefore, you can find it using Euclid's algorithm. Maybe it doesn't need saying, but you know which one is p and which one is q is kind of arbitrary. So it could be the bigger one or the smaller one that divides y plus 1 or y minus 1. Just because y plus 1 is bigger than y minus 1. Well, first of all, that's not totally, I mean, I guess that is, I mean, it's modular arithmetic, so bigger is not all that well defined. But it certainly is factors. It doesn't matter. OK, so Euclid's algorithm then will tell us p. And similarly, you can use Euclid's algorithm to find the GCD of y minus 1 and n to find q. Or you can just divide p into n and get q that way. OK? So that's where we are. So that's the classical number theory behind this problem. And so the problem we want to solve then is finding the order of x mod n. Unfortunately, there's no known, fortunately or unfortunately, there's no known classical algorithm to do that. But there is a quantum algorithm, that's Schur's algorithm. Okay. So before I start on Schur's algorithm, I want to make sure that everyone is, it's not actually totally important that you understand this. It's not, you just need to know what the problem is. But I think it's a good thing to know. So are people happy with that? Or is there questions? OK, so then let's do Schur's algorithm. So Schur's algorithm is an algorithm for finding the period of numbers, or finding the period of functions. And in particular, it'll find the period of this particular function, x to the a mod n. So, so let me draw up a circuit that Schur's algorithm is going to use, and then we'll kind of discuss it in more detail. So first, we're going to have two registers. So one register is kind of going to be the A register. And so that's going to start as all zeros. And one is going to be the X register. X to the A register, maybe. And that's also going to start as all zeros. OK, and the first thing we do is we put the A register in a superposition. We want to put in superposition of everything, so we're going to do Hadamards here. And then the next thing we're going to do is we're going to calculate the modular exponential. So we're going to calculate x to the a mod n, with the a here being given by the first register and the x to the a being stored in the second register. And then let's say we'll measure the second register. OK. The next thing we're going to do is we're going to do the Fourier transform. Make that bigger. Discrete Fourier transform, that's right. And so, yeah, so the Fourier transform is the Fourier transform over numbers mod 2 to the n for some little n. It's not big N. And so in particular, that operation takes a basis state A, and it's a quantum Fourier transform. So what it's doing is taking A to the sum over B, omega to the AB, B, where omega is a root of unity, e to the 2 pi I over 2 to the little n. Okay, and then once we've done the Fourier transform, we measure, and then we're going to do some classical post-processing. OK? So let's see. So let me call this step here t equals 0. And at this point, that will be 1. And this will be checkpoint 2. This is 3. And then at the end here, this is 4. So we're going to go through and see what the state is at each of these steps and try to understand how and why this algorithm works. Yeah?
What's the order of it?
Order 1. Like, I don't know if it's I mean, for large n, it's, I mean, I don't know if it's like a half or two-thirds or a quarter, but it's that's what I mean by order one. And it doesn't depend. I mean, it depends on n, but not very much. So it's asymptotically independent of n, basically. It probably fluctuates up and down a little bit. Okay. So everyone understand the circuit. I'll explain how to perform these things later. But the next thing to do is to go through and see why it works in an idealized case, actually. Okay? So this is much easier to analyze, as I said, in an idealized case. So what we're going to do for the moment is consider the case where R divides 2 to the little n. Okay, and actually, this never really happens in the case of interest. But it's much easier to explain what's going on when you make this assumption. OK, so at checkpoint 0, time 0, well, the x to the a register is all zeros. And the a register has had the Hadamard transform applied on it. So it's a superposition of all possible a's. So that's what we have. We have sum over a tensor 0. OK, hopefully that part is straightforward. So then let's go to the next time step. So the next time step is, well, we're basically doing a classical computation, but we're doing it on a superposition. So this gives us an entangled state. So now we have sum over a x to the a mod n. OK, so again, this should be relatively straightforward. This looks a lot like what we were doing with the Deutsch-Jose algorithm, at least in the version that had that had two Oracle calls. Okay. And so here's where it departs a bit from the Deutsch-Jose algorithm. So after step one, we measure this register. It turns out the measurement is not actually necessary, but again, it makes it easier to see what's going on. So what happens at step two? So what's happened at time two? So we made this measurement, and suppose the measurement result is z. So that's supposed to be x to the a mod n. Now, z tells us something about what a is. So it's going to collapse the first register. But it doesn't tell us everything about what a is, because this is a periodic function, right? And if two values of a differ by a multiple of r, they're going to have the same z. Okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to collapse this to only those values of a that are consistent with this z. So in particular, we then get a sum over a such that x to the a is equal to z of a, which is equal to sum over j of a0 plus jr, where a0 is some a0 that satisfies this. OK? So basically, what we've done is we've collapsed and we've gotten a state that looks like this, if you were to kind of plot it against it would be, so if this is the a axis, then we have spikes that are separated by r. And the first one will be at a0, second one, therefore, a0 plus r, a0 plus 2r, et cetera. Okay? So the period here is what we want to find. But we can't just measure the first register, because then we'd only get one spike. And these spikes are shifted by some unknown a0. Right? We know z, but we don't know how to find the a0 that gives us this. Okay? So here we have some state. It's periodic state. And we want to find the period. So this is where the Fourier transform comes in. That's what Fourier transform does, is it takes a periodic function and extracts the period. Okay. So then at step three, what does the Fourier transform do? Well, let's work it out explicitly. So we have sum over j of a0 plus jr. And a0 plus jr is going to go into that thing. So we get, then get a sum over b of omega to the a0 plus jr times b, and then ket b. And so then reversing the order of summation, we get sum over b omega to the a0b, and then sum over j omega to the jrb. Right. OK. So let's look at this thing. So sum over j omega to the jrb. Well, omega, we can plug in the value for that. So that's e to the 2 pi I jrb over 2 to the n. And let's put this r on the bottom. And remember that we picked the special case where this is an integer. Okay, so so then we get two cases. So in the case where j times b sorry, in the case where b is a multiple of this, so then this thing here is an integer. And well, this will always be 1, right? Because we have some multiple of 2 pi as the phase. So when this when that's the case, then these things will all add up. And we'll get, well, the kind of number of j's that we have. So in that case, it's about 2 to the n over r. If 2 to the n over r divides b. Now, if this is not an integer, this is some rational number, so if this is not true, then when j equals 1, we have some phase that's not 1, but it's a rational phase. And then we take multiples of it and add up all those multiples. So those multiples will kind of spread us around the unit circle, right? And that's the usual thing that happens with the Fourier transform, is those will add up to 0. Okay, so that's the other option. Okay, and so plugging this back in up here, that tells us that what we have is the sum over multiples of 2 to the n over r. Omega to the a0. So basically, we're restricting to those. We've done this sum. We're restricting to those b's that satisfy this. And so letting this equal to c, we get a0c. No, wait, is that what I did? A0 c 2 to the n over r. B. No, I don't want b equals c. Yeah. Anyway. So c is b over 2 to the n over r. So we have b up here. So this is what we have. And the phase is not really going to matter anymore because we're about to do a measurement. What is important is what we have here. Okay. And so again, we have something that's periodic, but now the periods are in a known location. And so that unknown a0 has appeared only in the phase. Okay. And so when we make the measurement, we don't care about the phase anymore. So at step four, we find that we get a random c. So we get c 2 to the n over r for random c. OK? And If you do this for a few C, if you do this a couple of times, so you run the whole algorithm a couple of times, well, you get a different C every time, probably. I mean, you get randomly chosen Cs every time. And so if C is relatively prime to this thing, then you're done. But even if it's not, then after you have a few Cs, you can deduce what 2 to the n over r is. And once you know 2 to the n over r, of course, you know r. Sorry? Well, C is totally random. Completely random.
If you have some number multiplying some random number, then it's always going to be random, isn't it?
No. So I made the assumption that 2 to the n over r is an integer. So when I say, when I say totally random, I mean it's a random integer. Okay? So the point is, this is an integer, but it's not a random integer, right? Because it's always a multiple of 2 to the n over r. And so what I want to do is I get a couple of numbers that are multiples of 2 to the n over r. Well, I've made that assumption. So in the real case, it's not going to be. And I'll discuss probably tomorrow what to do when it's not. No, that's not true. If you multiply, suppose 2 to the n over r is 5, okay, and you multiply by random integer 3 or 7 or 27, well, whatever you get will be a multiple of 5, okay? And so that's the only common feature that they have. And so in particular, by taking then the GCD of all of these numbers for different values of C, you get 2 to the n over r. Okay. Okay, good. Yeah. How many qubits do you need? Well, it's not that many. So I haven't really discussed how to do this part yet, or the Fourier transform yet. But for the steps I've written down, well, so what we're doing is we're actually picking A. So the easiest thing you might say is, well, we'll pick A up to big N, in which case writing down A would take up to log big N qubits. Actually, we're going to want A that's a bit higher than that. We're going to pick 2 to the N to be some number that's bigger than big N. So really, writing down A requires little n qubits. Okay, so it runs up to 2 to the n, but to write down a number up to size 2 to the n, you only need little n qubits. And then this thing, x to the a mod n, that's always going to be less than big N. So that requires log big N qubits. So basically, it requires order log big N qubits. And then there's going to be a few more scratch bits that are needed for the modular exponentiation. But that's, again, same order magnitude. So what I was writing on the left was just kind of the names of the registers, so you can remember what they do, what their purpose is. So it doesn't have any mathematical meaning. You mean all the way on the left of the circuit? Yeah, that's right. Any other questions on this algorithm so far? So the input is we're kind of designing the quantum circuit based on the classical input. So the classical input in this case is we're given x and n, and we want to find r. Right? So x and n appear mostly in the modular exponentiation. Okay, and n also goes a little bit into the general design of the circuit because it says how big we want to set little n. But basically, and then it also appear, they also appear in the classical they can appear in the classical post-processing too. Not to mention the pre-processing. But mostly they appear in the modular exponentiation. And so what's gonna happen is when we design the quantum circuit, we're gonna lay out gates in a way that depends on the classical input. Yeah.
Would you be able How big a number could you?
Let's see. So,
what's the biggest number you could factorize with current to the system?
So let me think. So, it depends a little bit. So with systems that are this small, people do a certain amount of cheating sometimes. Like to really calculate the modular exponentiation, you do want some scratch space, but you can probably get away with that for small size. There was an early experiment that factorized 15 using only like 3 qubits, I think. But really what they did is they only did the Fourier transform. They didn't do the modular exponentiation at all. Because they, you know what it is, right? And it's 5 times 3, by the way. So let's see. So if you really want to do this the whole algorithm correctly, I think the kind of the optimized, assuming you can do as many gates as you want, and you don't have to worry about that, it's just qubits that are the limit. I think the optimized thing is about like 3 log n, maybe. So let's say you had 15 qubits, so log n would be about 5. So you could factor numbers up to about 32. But you want it to be a product of 2 odd primes, because actually this whole business about, since you're finding an even power, it doesn't work well when n is even. So let's see, what's the... right, so you can't quite do 7 times 5. So 21 might be the biggest you can do. If you wanted to, you know, do it totally honestly and do the whole algorithm.
Yeah. The biggest so far?
I'm not sure. There may have been some experiments to factor 21. I'm not certain about that. But again, you know, it's with a certain amount of cheating, so they might have even gone a little higher than that. So the number limited down the number of gates is actually an important factor as well. I mean, in practice, because there's errors in each of these gates, and you do too many gates, so those errors build up. But in practice, you have an implementation. You know, you want to demonstrate something, so you just pick something. And factoring is kind of a nice thing, but it's also a little bit complicated in terms of it does require a fair number of gates for the given number of qubits. So frequently, they'll pick something a bit simpler to demonstrate. But yeah, so it's on the list of kind of benchmarks, things people want to do. Are there questions? Okay, so let's see. So let's start to discuss these subroutines. So let's do modular exponentiation first. How do we do the modular exponentiation efficiently? So if you're not smart about it, you might say, oh, well, that's easy. I want to take it's basically a classical computation, so let's think about how to do it classically. How would I take x to the a mod n? Well, I'll take x, and then I'll square it. I'll get x squared mod n. And then I'll multiply by x again to get x cubed mod n, and by x again to get x to the fourth mod n, and so on. But the problem is that a could go up to 2 to the little n. Okay, and so if you multiply 1 by 1, then that's a lot of multiplications. It's exponentially many multiplications. Okay, so that's no good. We can't do it that way. We have to be a little more clever. But it's not so hard. So what we're doing is modular exponentiation. Which takes a0 to a x to the a mod n. And so what we can do is we can do, again, some classical pre-calculation. And what we can do is pre-calculate the even or the powers of 2 powers. So x we know, we can calculate x squared, that's OK. And then from x squared, we multiply x squared times x squared, and so we can get x to the fourth. And then we can square x to the fourth to get x to the eighth, and so on up to x to the 2 to the n minus 1. okay? And then if we have some A, which can be written in binary notation as some AI 2 to the n minus 1 minus I. So in other words, we're writing it, yeah, just in binary notation. So then that means that we can do this by first doing this step. We'll take a bunch of extra ancillas and calculate x and then x squared to the a n minus 2, x to the fourth, the a n minus 3, and so on, x to the 2 to the minus 1 to the a 0. Okay. And so each of these is a straightforward controlled operation. So what you'll do is you'll say, look at this register here. This is, so you look at this register here, and you'll say, well, I'll either leave it alone if the bit an minus 3 is 0, or I'll add x to the fourth if the bit an minus 3 is 1. Okay? So that's a straightforward operation. And then what you can do is you can multiply these things together. And you see that there's only little n of them. So that's an acceptable thing to do. And so we multiply them together. We get this, a x to the a n minus 1 plus 2 a n minus 2 plus 4 a n minus 3 plus dot, 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 plus 2 to the n minus 1 a 0, which is exactly a. And I haven't been writing the mod n's, but of course, you could put them in everywhere. OK? And of course, so multiplying together is not the end. You then have to uncompute these first things. But that's, you know, the same stuff we were doing last week. OK, so how much time does this take? Well, so we have three steps here, basically. We have the pre-calculation. So the pre-calculation involves, so each time we square, that's one multiplication. And all these numbers are kind of the same size. They're all, you know, mod n size. So they're all order log n bits. So pre-calculation is going to take actually n minus 1 multiplications. And then the next step, so the quantum part contains, well, each of these is really just an addition. And so we have n of those. And this part then involves multiplying together all of these things. And actually, I guess we have to uncompute this. So let's say 2n. So multiplying together all of these, that's multiplying together n numbers. So it's really n minus 1 multiplications again. OK. So overall, we have order n operations. And the multiplications are the more time-consuming. So I think I said somewhere, multiplication takes, you know, long multiplication takes time O of n squared. So then the total complexity, well, OK, so long multiplication O of n squared. So then the total complexity of this part of the algorithm, the modular exponentiation is O of n cubed. Now, as it happens, log multiplication is not the most efficient way to do multiplication. There's better multiplication algorithms known, a variety of them. that are useful when you're multiplying really long numbers. And so asymptotically, the best one that's known is a fast multiplication scheme that takes time O of n log n log log n. So with fast multiplication, we get the total complexity is O of n squared log n log log n. Okay, and so if you're doing this for real with, you know, really big RSA keys, you may not want to use this most efficient fast multiplication scheme because the constants are kind of big. But you'll use some kind of fast multiplication scheme. So you'll be somewhere less than n cubed, then maybe somewhere a bit more than this. Somewhere between n squared and n cubed, basically. Okay? So that's enough for today, I think. I'll take questions on that, and then tomorrow we'll do the Fourier transform in the non-ideal case. But are there questions on the modular exponentiation or the general setup here? No? OK. Well, you get another chance tomorrow.